Welcome to the DFA Podcast. On today's show, we wrap up the trade deadline once more. We discuss Yonder, Alonso, and Ryan Garten. And then we talk about Sean Brody's inability to maintain his credit card. It's all here on the DFA Podcast.
Welcome to episode 21 of DFA, a podcast from Baseball Prospectus. I'm Brian Grossnick of BP, and joining me, my co-host, my partner in crime, RJ Anderson. RJ, how's it going, man?
It's going well. How was Sabre Seminar?
Sabre Seminar was fascinating. Sean's on. He was at Sabre Seminar as well. We had a great time. Lots of interesting stuff. Lots of great people. We got to watch Fernando Perez's breakout as an analyst and speaker. I highly recommend listening to the Effectively Wild that he was on because it's a hint at how interesting his presentation was. But yeah, there was lots of cool stuff going on, so it was definitely a very fun event. We also had a kind of a weird interaction. Sean and I have never met prior to this in person, and so Sean was able to recognize me through something about the podcast. You can tell our listeners about that briefly.
So I was sitting in the very back, and Jason Benetti was kind of moderating the whole thing. And so there was a pause and a break, and Benetti was talking about Edwin Jackson. He said, "Who's your favorite Edwin Jackson teammate?" So I looked to my right in the hallway, and just like a boisterous, loud pronunciation of "I am Brian Grossnick" was the response of Ricky Henderson. And I was like, "Oh, okay, there's Brian." Like,
yeah, that was... It's great. I'm easily identifiable by my love of Edwin Jackson facts. So that's great. So we'll throw out the same question to you, RJ. You weren't there, unfortunately. We would have loved to have seen you. But so do you have a favorite Edwin Jackson teammate you want to share?
I would go with Fred McGriff. I actually just wore a Fred McGriff Double-A jersey on Sunday. And... in addition to being, you know, a Devil Rays legend, McGriff sort of kind of helps connect Edwin Jackson to Babe Ruth. Because if you look back, Jackson and McGriff were teammates on the 2003 Dodgers. McGriff played with Phil Niekro for the 87 Blue Jays, who played with Gus Bell for the 64 Braves, who played with Ray Mueller with the 50 Pirates, who, by the way, played with Babe Ruth for the 35 Braves. So in case you were ever wondering, do Edwin Jackson and Babe Ruth have a connection? Yes, they do. And it actually requires, what, four teammates? So thank you, Fred McGriff, for that bit of trivia. And thank you, Fred McGriff, for the jersey that somehow still fits me, even though I got it when I was like 12 years old. So
that jersey probably has a story to it. I'm excited to talk about Fred McGriff because Fred McGriff's such a fun player. He's such a cool guy and a fun guy to talk about. He probably doesn't get enough credit these days, even though folks talk about him as a potential Hall of Fame guy. He doesn't seem to be getting that kind of recognition, but he was a heck of a player to watch. I hated him. Hated Fred McGriff because, you know, growing up as a Mets fan, I identified seeing him on TBS and playing for the Braves and just hitting dinger after dinger off of an assortment of crappy Mets starting pitchers. So it was bad times for me, but good times if you're a Devil Rays fan, because he was a fun guy to watch for that brief time he was with the team.
Yeah, I don't think there's such thing as good times for Devil Rays fans, but fair enough.
Well, speaking of good times, we had a great time doing the live show while you were unavailable. We had to bring in six guests to try to replace just one RJ Anderson. But we had a great show. We had a lot of fun talking about the deadline. But I did want to kind of get your thoughts about the deadline now that it's passed. We had some weird stuff going on where news was breaking while we were talking to folks. We had the perfect person on to talk about a Yu Darvish trade and Kate Morrison. And then Yu Darvish didn't get traded until 30 seconds before we had to move on to our next guest. So that was kind of a bummer. But we saw a lot of moves. We saw a lot of deals. And you were following along with everything. But I just kind of wanted to pick your brain a little bit on what deals you thought were kind of the most interesting, surprising, good, bad, specific stuff about the deadline or high-level stuff? What do you want to talk about when it came to this deadline as a transaction analyst and fan of baseball?
So I guess the two deals that I disliked involved the Rays and Astros. I really did not like the Tim Beckham trade for Tampa Bay. Mm-hmm. I feel like they just gave away depth to a team that's right there on their heels in the wild card race for no real reason. Because the prospect they got back, I know he's gotten some decent reviews publicly, but he wasn't in the Orioles' top 30, and that's a weak system, obviously. And I talked to a scout who I really trust, and he was like, yeah, he's not very good. So that combination, plus you look at the roster, and I know the excuse everyone uses as well, you know, Daniel Robertson is back, they have Ademus, they have Duffy potentially coming back, and I just don't buy any of that because, you know, rosters expand in, what, 3 weeks now?
Right.
You can find a way to get all those guys into September, and they brought up Taylor Feverston to replace Beckham. I know he's been sent back down for Robertson, but I just don't buy that. And if you look at their roster, especially their lineup against lefties, Beckham fits better than, you know, Edini Echeverria,
right,
who's been horrendous for them. And I just don't – I feel like you can make the case that Beckham is absolutely a better player than Echeverria, and I don't think Echeverria will be a part of the team next year even. So dumping him in general made no sense to me. Dumping him to the Orioles, who really needed shortstop help and who now have a cheap potential starter at shortstop for the next few seasons at the cost of a not-that-great prospect, that's inexplicable to me.
Yeah,
before
I just want to jump in on that. So according to Baseball Prospectus's metrics, WARP, in 87 games with the Tampa Bay Rays, Tim Beckham was worth 0.8 wins above replacement player, so almost a full win above replacement. In six games with the Baltimore Orioles, they haven't counted the most recent seventh game, he has been worth one win above replacement. He has actually been just hitting unbelievably since he went over to Baltimore. 3 homers in 6 games. Getting on base at a 600 clip. I'm with you 100%. I did not understand this at all from the Rays' perspective, unless it was something where they just hate his defense so much that they can't see past the fact that he's a good right-handed hitter, and he's not, you know, maybe he's not a part of the team going forward, but like there's guys on the team now who are far worse offensively, probably not that much better defensively. I just don't understand why you wouldn't hang on to him and try to do something in the winter where you don't give the Orioles a good bat for the stretch run.
Yeah. And I don't know if I buy that excuse either. The explanation seems to get pushed almost as much as that Beckham had a chip on his shoulder and he was not pleasant to be around all the time in the clubhouse because he complained about having to move off shortstop for Edini Echeverria. Well, I would complain about having to move off shortstop for Edini Echeverria if I were out playing him too. And also, this is the same team that has Brad Miller, who, by the way, complained about having to move off shortstop last deadline, and Brad Boxberger, who in the past complained about being used earlier than the ninth inning. Those guys are still in Tampa Bay. They didn't get unceremoniously dumped at the deadline, and they certainly didn't get a hit piece wrote about him afterward, where the best dirt you have is that he was sometimes obnoxious to beat writers. So, yeah, that doesn't work for me.
So, sorry to interrupt about that that other trade. Tell me the other one that you're most interested in.
Well, I guess it was just the Astros' deadline strategy in general. I understand that Liriano has more upside than, say, Jerry Blevins. But for my money, if you're going to go out there and try to get a left-on-left guy, I would acquire someone who is familiar with the role, who knows the rigors of getting ready on a whim. You know, you never know when you're going to need your left-on-left guy. He might come in the sixth. He might come in the eighth. So Liriano's history has been largely in the rotation. Maybe he makes a smooth transition. But for my money, if I'm going to go out there and get a left-hand specialist, I want a guy who's comfortable with the role and who has shown he can succeed in that role. The other general comment about Houston's deadline situation is they just didn't seem to do enough. And I understand that's a good team on paper. They don't necessarily have a lot of needs, but I would have liked to have seen them attempt to acquire a starting pitcher. I just don't trust the rotation because of the concerns I have about their durability. And, you know, Dallas Keuchel kind of said the same thing without saying the same thing when he said he was disappointed. And, yeah, I don't know. I just don't – I understand why Houston didn't do more, but to me it's probably going to be viewed as a missed opportunity, especially if they don't go on to the win the World Series or at least reach the World Series. So those were my two bugaboos about the deadline, so to speak. I just didn't get either approach. And the thing is, like, I was fine with the rest of the Rays' moves. I just didn't like that one, and I don't like starting Austin Pruitt when you're trying to win a wild card spot. Other than that, you know,
well,
I was
– I mean, but, Brett Honeywell is doing very well for Durham right now, and kind of a weird choice to bring him up as a kind of non-prospect, a guy who has put in the work in the Rays minor league system. But like, Brent Honeywell now is pretty much rolling in AAA, and I understand you don't want to start the service clock. I understand that he may not be a favorite, especially from a makeup perspective, from the Rays front office, but this seems crazy pants to me, especially with a guy like Blake Snell not coming up and performing. You know, the Rays do handle their pitchers with like serious kid gloves, but they have seen how that doesn't always work anymore. I mean, it worked for a great long period of time for them when they were bringing up all these great young pitchers and they were kind of sliding seamlessly into the rotation. But I kind of look at it with the failure of Blake Snell to kind of take that step from AAA to the majors, and it's like, well, maybe you just have to try something different with your starting pitching prospects. I mean, maybe the one-size-fits-all kind of philosophy isn't really working for them anymore.
Right, and I'll just note, because I talked about it with Beckham, that there are some murmurs of makeup issues with Snell out there as well, that maybe he's not doing the work they ask of him or whatever. And I'm just going to point this out as well. I know I just said that, but the Rays have had a lot of stories like this surface since Joe Maddon left. I mean, James Loney and Rene Rivera supposedly clashed with Kevin Cash. They jettisoned Nate Carnes. He publicly complained. They jettisoned Desmond Jennings for hustle-related reasons. Tim Beckham now. I know there's a few I haven't even mentioned. At what point do we just say this is on the front office and the manager? Because like guys like James Loney, you never really heard a bad word about them as clubhouse presences. Same with Rene Rivera. Like, he's seemingly a clubhouse favorite wherever he goes. And yet in Tampa Bay, I mean, at what point do we just say this is on the Rays for these communication failures or perceived makeup flaws and not on the players themselves?
Well, and another thing I would say you probably do that pretty early in the process, but another thing that's kind of interesting about the Rays is that I know that in the past under the Friedman administration, and I think some of it's carried over in the Silverman era, is that they have been more willing than other teams to go after guys that had perceived makeup issues or perceived troubled pasts or things like that. You saw that a lot of times with, you know, guys like Elijah Dukes or Lutke or some other guys who were not necessarily thought of very fondly around the league. Maybe part of it's a little bit of an issue of their own making. Maybe if they don't care about makeup that much, maybe they're not cultivating good attitude in the clubhouse. And that gets back to what you're saying, that, you know, maybe it's the manager, maybe it's the front office, maybe it's the reputation that they have of kind of similar to the Astros of commoditizing their players a little bit. That it's got real effects, and if it hurts them in player development, that's the Rays can't afford to have problems in player development because they can't address those issues in performance any other way.
Yeah, and I just think they've lost a lot more than we anticipated when Maddon and Friedman left. And, you know, that's not a diss on Kevin Cash or anyone necessarily, but it's just clear that they're not as well ran as they used to be in many ways.
Yeah. So that's those are some pretty pretty serious moves that teams have made. The Astros not making a move. I mean, both of those moves that you refer to, the Beckham and the Liriano moves, look in hindsight like poor decisions by the teams. Liriano has been very bad in his two appearances with the Astros. Beckham has been very good in his short-term appearances with the Orioles. Was there a move that you particularly liked for a particular team? I'll try to end it in this part of our discussion on a more positive note, maybe.
I never like any move for any team, Ryan. Don't you know that?
I know.
I guess I would say I like the Addison Reed move. I like Lucas Duda move. The cost on both seem pretty low. I'm trying to think of another one that really stood out to me. I found the Sonny Gray trade pretty interesting because, after the fact, the rumor surfaced that the Cardinals were offering some combination of Stephen Piscotty, Luke Weaver, or Jack Flaherty plus. So I thought that was an interesting look at how the A's might have valued upside versus certainty, including, the risk involved with getting some injured players back in that deal. Well, I don't know. What was your favorite move? Or what was the move that you would expect me to say here? Either one.
I don't know if I had much of an expectation because, I mean, you and I don't agree on everything when it comes to transactions, but I think that we do kind of see baseball in kind of a similar light. So I wasn't projecting on myself that like you'd particularly like a deal or not. Just real quickly to talk about Gray. We were going to talk about this later in the show, but Piscotty's now been sent down to AAA, and that kind of makes me think that the Cardinals have pretty much given up on the guy. I mean, if they were offering him for Sonny Gray, and now they didn't get that done, so they send him down to AAA. I mean, that's very concerning to me about how they view Piscotty long term, which is kind of a surprising thing now, given his background and how good of performance he had in previous seasons. So that's kind of neat to me. But as far as a move goes that I liked or that I thought you might be positive on, I'm still very bullish on the Dodgers' acquisition of Yu Darvish. I am an unabashed Yu Darvish fan. I expect him to be, one of these really top-flight aces when he's healthy. I think that all the contextual factors make this a very good fit for him in Los Angeles, as opposed to if he would have gone to a team like the Yankees or the Nationals or something else like that. Los Angeles seems like a very seamless fit, and I do think that the guys that the Dodgers gave up in return for Darvish, they're talented. They paid a lot for this rental, but at the same time, I feel like the Dodgers had the right stock to do this. I think the Dodgers are a team that really will value having the extra 2 months of team control to try to lock him up long term if that's something they want to do. So I do think that was a really good trade from their perspective. I'm not sure for the Rangers if Willie Calhoun's going to be like the guy for them, but I mean, I hear a lot of really great things about his bat. And if his bat plays, I'm less concerned about his inability to play defense, as it's called before. But I don't know, what'd you think about the Darvish trade?
I liked it for the Dodgers for certain. And, they didn't give up one of their top three prospects. I think you had said they were. I think I said fourth or fifth, right? So I
Yeah,
technically,
you win.
I won, thank goodness, because otherwise I would have been so embarrassed, I'm curious about Calhoun. However, the Dodgers really had no fit for him. And so he was sort of an extra piece. That's not insulting his talent or anything. Just, he didn't fit in the Dodgers' plans whatsoever. And the other prospects they gave up, I don't think that system is going to miss them,
Right.
even though, they have some interesting potential on their own. So I understood it from the Rangers' perspective as well. They seemingly got a solid package, albeit one that the Dodgers are kind of just going to shrug at. I guess I was mostly curious if the Rangers weren't willing to hold on to Darvish and try to extend him. I wonder if it's just a matter of they feel comfortable enough trading him now and attempting to re-engage him this winter, or if they have kind of given up the ghost on re-signing him, period. But yeah, I did like that deal for the Dodgers and the Rangers. And yeah, I'm curious to see how that plays out in the postseason. Kershaw, Darvish rotation, plus maybe Alex Wood or Rich Hill or whoever the Dodgers want to throw out there. And I will preemptively say good luck to whoever they face because, my goodness, that could be a devastating combination.
Yeah, that's a mess. If enough of those guys are healthy, that is going to be really rough on anybody in the division series or the any sort of playoff series. But the one game playoff, like, can you imagine if the Dodgers are like, well, we got to win this wild card playoff, which is unlikely. Of course, they're looking like they're going to run away with the West, but God forbid they came into a one game playoff and like, well, we'll just go Kershaw 3 innings, Darvish 3 innings, and then Jansen for like the last three. Like, I would just give up. I would say, okay, we forfeit. We're gonna take the Pirates route and lose.
Oh,
And
and there was one more deal that I think we should mention here as a favorite. And this one's a big one that I'm surprised we haven't talked about in general. Adam Rosales to the Diamondbacks.
Sean, Adam Rosales is back with the Diamondbacks. They also picked up Emilio Bonifacio to show you around the same time to display how they look at these kind of players. I could not care less. The Diamondbacks, man, I just could not care less about this. And, yes, Chris Owings is injured, but this is not important at all. Sean, how do you love your Adam Rosales move? Are you happy to see him in Arizona?
So when they played the Cubs the other day, they batted him like second or third against John Lester because apparently he's like a lefty killer. Batted him before Paul Goldschmidt, before JD Martinez. What propels you to be like, you know what? Rosales has been like genuinely uninteresting his entire career. What should we do with him today? Oh, we should bat him second.
Yeah, he's the guy who's gonna shake up John Lester enough so that Goldschmidt can really get in there and hit against him. Well, that is your Adam Rosales minute from Sean Brody for today. I knew you would know something about what he's been doing, what he's been up to since there. And of course, you're like, yeah, of course, he's been batting second against him. Like, this is the kind of information that you can only get from Sean and from our podcast. So thank you.
I get updates.
So now we'll talk about a post-deadline move. It's August. We've got August trades, waiver trades. Guys are slipping through waivers left and right. So one of those moves that was, well, let's go back for a second. It's the past the trade deadline. It's a time for teams to make trades, and Jerry Depoto is making more trades because that's what he does. He compulsively makes trades. And so he's made two more trades. He's acquired Yonder Alonso for Bauk Powell. And he's acquired Ryan Garten and a minor league catcher, and he's given up a bunch of prospects that we don't really care about too much. And so he's made some moves to address the Seattle Mariners post deadline by adding Alonso and by adding Garten, I guess. I don't know if that really matters too much, but we can talk about that a little bit. So, but RJ, how do you feel about Jerry Depoto making these trades, trying to add to the Mariners 25-man roster? Even though it still is kind of up in the air whether or not they're going to be competing for that wild card spot.
I like it. This is a team built to win now. We've talked about them a few times. There's no sense holding back for 2018 or 2019 right now. Go forward as much as you can and try to make the postseason. And, I'm not sure if the Mariners are good enough to do so. However, right now they're like a game back in the wild card race. And yes, it's messy. You have the Royals, the Rays, even the Orioles and Twins are all within 3 games of a wild card position. However, why shouldn't Jerry Depoto go out there and make a move to try and improve? And I mean, he didn't give up much here. Like, Alonso has been bad since the All-Star break. He's got like 2 home runs after the All-Star break compared to 20 before. But he gave up Bauk Powell, who has kind of gotten passed around lately. If you remember, the A's originally had Bauk Powell, and they traded him to the Rays in the Zobrist slash, Escobar trade, and then he got passed over to Seattle in the Brad Miller deal, or one of the other 100 of Rays Mariners trades. I mean, we have one to talk about here. Jerry Depoto just really likes those Rays guys, I guess. But yeah, I was perfectly fine with the Mariners going out there and trying to get at minimum a platoon partner with Danny Valencia. What about you?
I like the deal. I have no problem with the deal. I think that Yonder Alonso is one of those guys where, you have to get him as a distressed piece. He was fabulous at the beginning part of the season. He has been, let's just say, less than fabulous since then, but still is like his line for the season is still 40% better than league average as an offensive player, which is something the Mariners could really use, even if the regression is going to, like, maybe he'll be a little bit better than average for the rest of the season, but not a lot. That's still a good platoon partner for Valencia. The thing that's kind of weird to me is the way that the team is acquiring him as this partner for Valencia instead of giving Dan Vogelbach a shot. Now, Vogelbach is a guy they acquired in the offseason. They gave up some legitimate talent to get him, and he's been hitting very well in AAA, and they've only given him something like, a handful of plate appearances this season. And I'm kind of interested to find out why they are more hesitant to bring him up and give him a shot as opposed to Alonso, because I don't think the two of them are going to be wildly dissimilar from an offensive standpoint now that Alonso has regressed. They're probably seeing something that I'm not seeing or that others aren't seeing because they wouldn't have made this decision otherwise. As much as we joke about it, Jerry DePoto is not just trading to make trades. He is trading to try to improve his team. So he obviously sees a reason that Alonso would be enough of an upgrade over somebody like Vogelbach to give up Powell, who's he's going to be a major league ball player. It's not like they're giving up a value, an asset with no value for him. So I'm just kind of interested to see what that might be.
I would just guess that he wanted two options instead of one. And Alonso is sort of works in the sense that you can use Alonso as plan A. If it looks like he's going to stink for the next few weeks, then you can bring up Vogel back and sort of ease him into the role. Because, I mean, Alonso is a free agent at season's end. And frankly, if he's been struggling, you know, he'll probably take that demotion to a lesser role in stride or whatever. No, he probably wouldn't actually because he's a free agent at season's end. But you know what I'm saying? Like, you know, at that point, you can kind of just make a move and deal with it for 2 or 3 weeks. Also, I would just say, like, the Mariners have had a lot of success with their fringe outfield prospects lately.
Yeah.
They chose well in a couple of trades. You know, Ben Gamel has been much better than anyone anticipated when they acquired him last August. Mitch Haniger has obviously done very well. You can even perhaps list someone like Guillermo Heredia. I know he doesn't have outstanding raw numbers, but you know he's had his uses this year. So credit to DePoto for that. He has definitely done, I would say, better than anticipated when it comes to trading for these guys. And we're going to see now if he's just as good when he trades them away. And, you know, Boog Powell is sort of a tweener, which this roster didn't really need another one of. But you're right, he's going to be a major leaguer. It's just a matter of whether he's good enough to be a fourth outfielder or if he's more of a fifth outfielder and spends a lot of his days in AAA. And of course, the Mariners also made a small deal with the Rays that I referenced earlier, getting, well, the most notable part of a trade, let's put it this way, was Ryan Garten, who, if you've never heard of him before, made 7 appearances earlier this season for the Rays. He's made 44 appearances total. He is a 27-year-old right-handed reliever who, in those 44 career appearances, has a 5.26 ERA and has allowed almost 1.5 home runs per 9. He does have a decent strikeout-to-walk ratio at 2.63, but he has a straight low to mid-90s fastball that has some rise on it, and his secondary pitch of choice is an upper 80s cutter. That's about all you need to know about Ryan Garten. He's a deaf piece, maybe, just maybe, has a season or two as a usable middle reliever, but there's not a whole lot more there. Unless I'm missing something. I don't know, Brian. You did the Rays comments last fall. Am I missing something about Ryan Garten?
I don't think so. The one thing, I wrote up Garten for today's transaction analysis baseball prospectus, today being Tuesday for anyone listening. And the one thing I noticed about Garten that was kind of interesting is that cutter has really gone down in velocity. He lost some velocity off it a little bit when his cup of coffee with the Rays so far this year. It had gone down a little bit at the beginning of the season. It seems to have gone back up a little bit in velocity before. But Garten, when I was doing those Rays comments, I found out that he was a big weighted ball training guy. And another thing from Sabre Seminar that we saw a presentation, I don't know entirely how much credence to give to it, but you hear sometimes about weighted ball velocity guys having kind of pop-up velocity, and then the velocity can go back down afterwards. You know, sometimes it's more of a short-term bump in velocity. So I would be concerned about him because if he loses any velocity, since he's already kind of a fringy reliever, I would be concerned about him being able to at all stick in the major leagues. Whereas now he could be an up and down guy. He could have a couple of good seasons as a seventh inning guy or a sixth inning guy. All that having been said, you know, the Mariners need to make some moves to try to address their bullpen. David Phelps, they brought in. That was a good idea. He's injured now, but that was a good idea in theory. Getting a guy like this who has some upside, but, you know, isn't what you would consider a reliable option there. Those are kind of the moves that, you know, a team's got to make to hope you hit on one of them and get it to work. So I like the deal for the Mariners. It's just, I don't have a ton of faith that he's going to turn into something where you're all of a sudden going to have a reliable seventh inning guy, or you're going to have a setup guy that's really exciting.
I agree with that. And just to note, in 33 AAA innings this season. He has struck out 12.5 batters per nine, but he's also walked 4.4. So keep an eye on whether the command allows him to play in the majors. Or, I don't know, like you said, is there something causing that spike in walks? You know, is it possible he's dealing with an injury? Or is this just a case where in 2016 he somehow found a way to walk fewer than three for the first time in a couple years, and now he's just reverting to his old wild ways? Because if he's reverting to his old wild ways, I don't think the formula will work. But as you mentioned, there's a chance they get a decent seventh inning reliever if they can work with him, and maybe he'll lean more on the cutter. I don't know. They probably have something in mind. And to the Mariners' credit, you know, they've had some success with smaller bullpen acquisitions, whether it's, you know, Tony Zeich or Pazos, who was having a decent season last I checked, or
Nick Vincent,
whomever. So,
yeah, there's some guys. There's some guys that they've been able to do well with. So we're going to move things along a little bit, go into those smaller moves that have been made since the deadline. So, Sean, can you hit us with a couple of these batting practice topics?
So Sean Rodriguez was traded back to the Pirates, and I guess we need to put out like a little alert to all Gatorade coolers that he's back.
That's a good joke. We never get tired of watching him beat up a Gatorade cooler, I don't think.
He is my favorite bellicose mineral infielder. The thing about Rodriguez that I find interesting, and you know, Rodriguez is basically became known as a utility player who can hit lefties and has a lot of strikeouts, but makes up for it with occasional power. So the thing about Rodriguez that I found interesting, though, is, well, let me just put it this way. How many pinch hit home runs do you think Rodriguez has for his career? And how many do you think he had entering the year? And this, Sean, you can answer too.
I mean, my guess would be that he's had a fair number of pinch hit home runs. He's known for his power. So I would guess coming into the season, given his years playing in Tampa Bay, let's just shoot for like, you know, six pinch hit home runs going into the season or for his career. I don't see that changing too much.
Five or six was what I was going to go with too.
Okay, so you both went with five or six. Good to know. So here's the thing. He had zero entering the season.
Wow. That's surprising. I'm surprised.
Yeah, zero. And well, here's the thing though. Well, on top of that, he has three this year, including already one for the Pittsburgh Pirates, who traded for him just, you know, a couple days ago. So that's impressive to me. Like, I would not have. Oh, excuse me. He had one in his career. I misread that. Well, I just ruined the fun fact. Well, I guess
I wouldn't say you ruined it, but it was that is really interesting to hear.
Yeah, he had one entering the year. He hit that last. Hold on, I just lost it. Oh, he hit that last September, and he has two this year, including one off Zach Greinke. Because you know, when you think of Sean Rodriguez, you think of Zach Greinke killer.
So the Pirates love these guys, right? Like they had Matt Joyce last year. He had four pinch hit home runs. Like that was his thing.
Yeah. They're good at identifying guys who can do that.
Adam Lind will be a Pirate soon is what you're saying.
I think this is a fun trade because, you know, one of the things I touched on in my transaction analysis about this is kind of him returning to the scene of his greatest successes. And after the kind of year that he's had with his injury, he was involved in a what was reported at the time is a pretty terrible car accident in the offseason just after signing that deal with the Braves to kind of maybe come in and be the starting third baseman. I really felt for the guy, scary situation for him and his family. And then to be able to come back and play okay for the Braves, but then he got traded to a team where he obviously played very well. And then in his first, you know, return to the team, he hit a dinger and was able to walk it off for the Pirates. And it seemed like a really cool story. So I'm happy for him in that regard. On the other hand, like, this doesn't seem like it's the best situation for him from a player performance standpoint. Like, I think he wanted the opportunity to play every day. I don't think he's going to get that in Pittsburgh, even though Pittsburgh is now considerably worse than they were before. So I really want to see him get the chance to be like that guy who plays consistently for 140 games. And I don't know if that's ever going to happen for him at this point.
I would say no.
So moving forward now, the White Sox claimed former prospect DJ Pederson, and do you guys want to talk about just kind of the descent, I guess?
I mean, I don't have strong feelings about DJ Pederson other than the fact that I'm surprised that his descent was as rapid as it was. And, you know, this is a guy who went from being one of the top prospects in the Mariners system to being one of the probably wouldn't crack the top 20 or 30 in the White Sox system because they're so stacked. I don't know about this guy. I really don't. I'm not a prospect writer. I'm not a prospect expert. I really wish that he would have been able to make it work for him. But, you know, the Mariners have seemed to have a lot of player development struggles when it comes to guys they've drafted recently, and that would be a red flag for me.
Yeah, and I'm fine on the White Sox taking a chance on him. He's probably not going to amount to much. And, you know, he's not even really a third baseman anymore. He's played more games at first base this year, although he's gotten a fair amount of time at third base as well. But yeah, he's hitting, or he was hitting, excuse me, 264, 323, 414 in the Pacific Coast League, which is not a good sign. Last year, he was only slightly better, a 745 OPS and about 200 plate appearances in Triple A, so you know, I don't mind the White Sox taking a gamble on a popular name, albeit one whose game no longer is popular itself.
I do wonder, since he's got a little bit of an injury history, if just getting to a point where he gets some regular reps and, you know, some consistent training and that kind of thing might help him out and might make him a little bit of a post-hype breakout, but I wouldn't plan on it.
I agree with that, but you know, he's also going to turn 26 the last day of the year, and at some point, you know, perform or you're going to be labeled a quad A. Oh, not even a quad A guy. He's more like a, I mean, what's the
Triple A
step
guy.
below quad? Yeah, I was gonna say, what's the step below quad A? Because he's not even performing well in Triple A, so he might find himself back in Double A at some point. It's just an organizational dude.
Yeah, for sure.
So speaking of Triple A, Jordan Montgomery option down. Is this surprising? I think when the Sonny Gray trade happened, I certainly felt that Montgomery might have been a guy that the A's were targeting because they kind of like to get guys off the big league roster in addition to prospects. I don't know if you guys are similar in saying in that, but do you think that Montgomery is going to come back by the end of August, or is he going to be a September call-up?
Well, remember, they also got Jaime Garcia. So if they had just stopped, or rather, if they hadn't traded for Garcia and just dealt for Gray, I think Montgomery would still be in the rotation. However, they're at this point now where they have also, you know, Sabathia and Tanaka and Luis Severino and Gray and Garcia. So they have five starters now, and you know, you can't option Sabathia. You're not going to move Tanaka to the bullpen. You know, Severino has been outstanding, so what are you going to do there? I think this is just a matter where, you know, the numbers game and the option flexibility left Montgomery exposed because he was the only choice to make there, barring a last second injury. And, you know, I kind of like Montgomery as a number four type. You know, he has a decent arsenal of pitches. He's a big guy. You can see him eating some innings. And it's not like he's performed too poorly on the season. He has a 4.05 ERA, pretty nice strikeout to walk ratio. Yeah, I think this is just a matter of where he lost out because he has options and because he's not making, you know, 20 million a year or whatever.
Yeah, this is one of those things where I think that the Yankees didn't make a mistake by trading for Jaime Garcia, but I do think they're in a position where they have to run out there their best five starting pitchers, and that group includes Jordan Montgomery. So sending him down to AAA from a procedural and from a roster issue, you have to do it because you can't send down Sabathia and you can't send down Garcia, and you need to have this depth in case something happens. But you said, like, you know, his ERA has been just a hair under four, and Jordan Montgomery, his deserved run average is, you know, like light years better than Jaime Garcia. He is probably for the season been much more effective than CC Sabathia. So this is a guy who, when it comes time for the end of the season and this playoff push, if you need to win the most games, he should be in the rotation. And so that for me is a thing where I would really hope this doesn't have a deleterious effect on his performance. Because he's the, in addition to that, he's also the guy who next year you're going to want to slot into the rotation. It's not going to be Sabathia. It's not going to be Jaime Garcia. It's going to be Jordan Montgomery. So sometimes I feel like maybe you just need to ride with the guys you've got, and maybe you've got to stash Sabathia on the disabled list, or, you know, do the unthinkable and move him into the bullpen for a little bit. But you don't do that to CC Sabathia because he's CC Sabathia. It's just
Yeah.
unfortunate that I think that they're pulling their best well, not their best starting pitcher, but one of their five best starting pitchers out of the rotation when they really could use him.
Yeah, that's fair. I don't really have much to add there. I just see this as, you know, these things tend to work themselves out, and they'll probably suffer an injury in the next week, and he'll be right back in the majors, and we'll just look back like, why did we waste 5 minutes talking about this when it proved, you know, irrelevant within a week? So
that is a very astute observation. Very, very smart thing to say.
So next up, Carter Capps was called up for the Padres. He didn't break camp with the team. I think he had a pretty bad spring training, but he is a 2.81 ERA in AAA, 3.13 FIP, nice little strikeout rate. Last night he was not so good. On Monday night, gave up 3 earned runs and walked 2, and just did not have a good outing. Do we think that Capps is going to turn it around? Do we think this is because of how MLB has messed with his kind of normal pitching motion?
I don't know. I will say this. His velocity was way, way down. If you remember Carter Capps, there in 2014 and 2015, he was sitting around like 98, 99 miles per hour. And last night he was sitting closer to 93. So that's kind of a red flag for me, given how much time he missed due to, you know, Tommy John surgery. I mean, he missed the entire 2016 season and most of 2015. I'm a little concerned here that maybe he's a case where we're going to look back and say, you know, the surgery kind of derailed his career. And I certainly don't hope that, but that's a huge velocity loss. And it's not one that we typically associate with guys who come back from Tommy John surgery. It feels like usually their velocity is, for the most part, where they left it. And this is, I mean, this would be career low levels for him, I believe. And, by 2 or 3 miles per hour, even.
And a lot of the strength of Carter Capps is in that ability to improve his effective velocity by getting so much extension, the crow hop delivery that he's got. And so it makes it look like his fastball is faster. If his fastball, if perception-wise, is at 96 miles an hour, that's fine. There's probably 100 to 125 relievers in Major League Baseball who can do that. So yeah, we're no longer at the point where that's really something that's a special event for a relief pitcher. I think that the Padres know more about this than we do. The Padres are a team where if Carter Capps was pitching well and he was looking like he would have been an effective reliever in the major leagues this season, I really feel like the Padres front office would have had him up and pitching in the major leagues right away, because they could have used him as a trade chip. They could have, you know, they were obviously working very hard to have a solid bullpen to back up their incredibly terrible rotation. I think that we can learn a little bit from what they didn't do in terms of promoting him into the majors until after they traded away like their entire bullpen, as a sign that they probably don't have a lot of confidence that he's coming back from this and going to be effective in the future.
I agree with that. Well, let's hope he does turn around. Obviously, yeah, he was one of the more thrilling pitchers to watch, and it would be a shame if, you know, he's 26 years old. It would be really a shame if his career was, well, he's 27 now. Sorry, his birthday was yesterday. So happy birthday, Carter Capps, and hopefully you got your velocity as a gift.
So our next one, we're going to stick with kind of the Tommy John theme. Edwin Volquez needs Tommy John surgery. Of course, he threw that no-hitter earlier in the season. And then Matt Shoemaker doesn't need Tommy John surgery, but he needs to have his radial nerve. He needs to have surgery on his radial nerve in his right forearm. So I've kind of got experience in both these areas, and they're not fun injuries.
So let's talk a little bit about Edison Volquez as a pitcher. Like, he is a weird starting pitcher. He is not he's a guy who barely hangs on in terms of his control to begin with. And what I understand about Tommy John surgery is that command and control are the last things to come back after TJS. So, you know, Volquez has traded for years on his ability to pitch a bunch of innings and have just enough command to get by as kind of a middle to back of the rotation starter. When we talk about injuries derailing careers, I have no doubt that Volquez can come back from the injury and maybe even get his velocity back to where it was before. But if he loses even a tick of command, I have to think he's done.
That's fair. And I would just note, Volquez went on the disabled list with a knee issue. So the arm issue sort of popped up out of nowhere. When Don Mattingly mentioned he was probably going to need surgery, everyone assumed they meant something with his knee, not his arms. So that was kind of a interesting twist to this story.
And the other thing about Volquez that's kind of interesting is that, I mean, when you look at it from the Miami Marlins perspective, they signed him to a 2-year deal. He was supposed to be kind of the anchor of the rotation, the guy that everyone else kind of rotated around. He wasn't supposed to be the ace. I mean, maybe he was, and if that's the case, well, that sucks. But I mean, he was kind of the guy who was going to be the one person you could rely on in that rotation. The rotation now is Dan Straley. He's pretty good. They should have traded him, but he's pretty good. Jose Urena, who is surprisingly doing well right now. And then Chris O'Grady, Vance Worley, and Adam Conley, which is like, I don't know. It sounds like a really, really bad back of the rotation there. And they don't have anything coming, and they are just, you know, Wei Yin Chen's been injured, but it doesn't matter because he's horrible. I just feel like this team, once again, this offseason, needs to go out and get like 3 starting pitchers.
Yeah, and I'll just note O'Grady left Monday night's game with an injury.
Oh,
so,
geez.
Yeah, and then, of course, Shoemaker, we talked earlier this season about how I believe we both thought that he would make an interesting trade ship. Unfortunately, they did not trade him, and now he's injured. And, you know, this is, you know, Shoemaker's older than everybody realizes. He's going to be 31 at the end of September, coming off a season which he had decent numbers, but it was actually the worst strikeout-to-walk ratio of his career, the worst FIP of his career because of the home run problem he's had. I'll be interested to see if the Angels try to make a move with him during the winter. Not necessarily a non-tender, but just see if they'll, you know, try and trade him or if they're going to hold on to him and hope he rebuilds some of his value next season. But this has been a rough year plus for him.
Yeah, I couldn't have said that better myself. That's exactly how I feel about him.
So, if I'm not mistaken, Volquez was brought in to kind of take the place of Jose Fernandez since his passing, and they really had the hole in the rotation. Volquez's contract runs up at the end of 2018, so this means he might actually miss all of next season. Do you think that that will play a role in how Volquez's career progresses going forward? Because at that point, I think he'll be 35 or 36. He'll be unsigned. Do we think that helps him? Do we think that – what do you think about that?
I mean, he'll get a 1-year pillow contract or something if he wants one. You know, the one thing that you would have to consider in situations like this, which are kind of late-game Tommy John surgeries in terms of a pitcher's career, is going to be coming off and going to, you know, perhaps having no team. How invested are the Marlins going to be in rehabbing him? How invested is he going to be in his own rehab when he's kind of nearing the end of his career anyway? I kind of wonder if this is something where the Marlins might want to go out and say, hey, you know what? We'll tack another year on to the end of this deal at $4 million or something like that. And maybe that would be a best case scenario for both player and team so that there's a goal to work towards and that the team is invested in his rehab and that he's invested in doing something for 2019 because I don't know, from the personal and motivational issue, I feel like that's got to be really challenging at this stage in his career.
So our next one's going to be Robbie Ray. Ray was hit with a fastball in the head off of – I can't remember the bat of who it was off of.
Luke Voll.
And it – scary injury. He's been on the 7-day concussion list since, and I think he just got moved to the 10-day. But he is supposed to resume throwing on Friday, so Do you think that Robbie Ray will be the same as he was when he gets back? How much do we think this plays a role into the Diamondbacks' chances to reach the playoffs and the rotation in general?
Well, I have no idea what effect it'll have on Ray. Hopefully none. I do think Diamondbacks will be fine, provided this isn't a long-term issue. They have a decent lead in the wild card, and you know, they've found ways to hang in it this long. Obviously, their pitching depth is not what you would particularly like to have. And you definitely don't want Ray going down right before the postseason. But hopefully he makes a quick and full recovery. And we're not even talking about this in a month's time.
Yeah, I'm 100% on board with that. You talk about the Diamondbacks not having a lot of depth. But kind of interestingly, the one guy that they called up to replace him is pretty much kind of a perfect replacement in Anthony Banda. He's a top prospect. I mean, he's a guy who not only is the top prospect kind of by consensus in the Diamondback system, but he's an actual good prospect. He's not one of those guys where he's the top, you know, a top prospect by default. He was pitching very well comparatively, I would say, in Reno for the team. He's done okay-ish in his two starts for the Diamondbacks. His DRA is horrible, but his ERA has been fine. He's been getting strikeouts at the major league level, which is a good sign. I think that the Diamondbacks are going to be fine. I'm not really concerned for them as a team, and you know, Robbie Ray's such a fascinating case. You know, you never know what somebody's going to respond to after an injury like this, but I would assume he'll probably be okay if there are no long-lasting concussion-related or other issues that he crops up into. I think his arm is great.
For as much as Zach Greinke has improved going into this year, Robbie Ray has almost paralleled that. I mean, he's dropped almost over a run and a half on his ERA, striking out guys at the same rate. Really, nothing has changed except he's just stopped giving up as many base hits as BABIP has dropped. So I think it's interesting just kind of like how cool the change has been from Greinke and Ray 2016 to Greinke and Ray in 2017.
Yeah, it's they're a fun team to watch this year.
So the time is finally here. Ahmed Rosario is on the Major League roster. I don't know if you ever thought this day would come, Brian. I thought – like, there was a rumor going out that he was just a myth, he wasn't a real player. So, Ed, what do you think? Are we happy that Rosario is up now? Do we think that the Mets are still Metsing by calling him up at this point in the season?
I mean, it's silly that they called him up now and not earlier. I think we can kind of agree on that. You know, if you want to play service time games, fine, play your service time games. But the timing of this is silly. He should have been up earlier in the season, but after, you know, the Super 2 deadline. Now that he's up, there's no reason to be anything but excited from him. If you listen to very, very smart Mets prospect watchers in Jeff Paternostro and Jarrett Seidler, you'll know that he is a very solid defender. He has turned into an elite runner in terms of speed, at least. He has been hitting triples since coming up to the majors, which is awesome because shortstops who hit triples tend to be awesome to watch. He's a good ball player. His hit tool may not come around for a couple of years. Right now, there's one way you could look at him and be like, maybe he's going to be like an Alcides Escobar or Elvis Andrews type player, which is like, oh, that's kind of disappointing, but it's also really valuable. So I think he's going to be fun to watch. He's going to be great for Mets fans. I am surprised that he's here now, but I am ready for him to be a terrific part of this team going forward. So I think he's going to be a lot of fun to watch, if nothing else.
Yeah, he has been a lot of fun to watch, even with some early struggles. I think he has like 10 strikeouts in his first 20-something plate appearances, but he can run, and he can defend, and that's pretty fun. So
our next one now, J.D. Davis and Jaimar Candelario also received the call-up. So which of these is going to have the greater success this season?
Well, Candelario doesn't seem like he's even going to play, so that's certainly suspect. At the same time, J.D. Davis doesn't seem like he's a long-term fixture either. So I guess I go with Davis because he seems like he might play. But Candelario might end up getting Brad Ausmus fired if the front office really wants him to play. So maybe it's Candelario after all, just from a different lens.
Yeah, the Candelario thing is kind of interesting because he's really only a third baseman. And Nick Castellanos is really only a third baseman. So there's not a lot of space for these guys as long as they're committed to giving Victor Martinez a whole lot of plate appearances and Miguel Cabrera a lot of plate appearances. You should give Miguel Cabrera a lot of plate appearances. Victor Martinez, now that you're a rebuilding Tigers team, maybe that's a mistake. I mean, look at the rest of the team. They're running out there lots of young players. Jim Adducci is a regular. Mikey Maddock.
Jim Adducci is not young.
But you know what I mean. Like, Jim Adducci is not young. You're very right about that. But Jim Adducci is a player that they need to kind of see what they have. And so it's like that with Dixon Machado, with James McCann, with Mickey Maddock. They're not going to win the Central. Like, it's not even close to that. So you're going to have to make room for Candelario and see what you got with him somewhere. And, you know, why put Victor Martinez in there instead? J.D. Davis, you mentioned like, oh, well, he might get a chance to play. where? Like, you know, they're going to play him over Bregman at third. They're going to slot him in at DH to replace Carlos Beltran. But now that Beltran's actually hitting again, like, I don't see that really happening. Davis is like one of those guys where the best case scenario is going to be like Russell Branion, which would be fun. But yeah, let's wait and see next year. I think that he's a guy who's going to be more or less blocked. And, you know, he'll be one of those guys who will be fun to watch when they decide to give the vets a rest. And that's about it.
Yeah, I agree with that. And maybe they should rest Miguel Cabrera, because I don't think he's been quite right all season long. And
no.
Resting him, he probably wouldn't go for it, but it would probably make sense for them versus playing him. Plus, you know, it helps them get a better draft pick, which is almost certainly on their mind at this point of the year.
So, our last segment, Max Fried, Lucas Sims, and Ozzy Albies. All called up for the Braves. This is kind of their next generation of people. Ozzy is actually one of two players in professional baseball who are younger than I am, so I'm kind of proud of that one. But do we think this signals to the Braves fan base that since they're not just September call-ups, that the Braves are ready to put their competition window, they're ready to kick their competition window open, and they're going to be a big player in the offseason, and they're going to go for it in 2018?
Maybe, but I'm going to be honest. I have a lot of reservations about Albies because he does not walk. It's not going to hit for a ton of power. And why am I having Jose Peraza's name pop into my head right now? Because that's unfortunate. That's kind of what the situation reminds me of. Brian, am I wrong here?
Well, he's off to a good start in his first six games in terms of that approach. He has been walking like gangbusters. Like, he's not hitting, but he's walking, which is exactly the opposite of what he should be doing, or what we expected him to be doing, which is to hit and never walk. Because I do think his hit tool is a little bit better than Peraza's. I just from what I've heard, I have a little bit more faith in him. He needs the everyday reps. They have to get him going. But to answer your question, Sean, no, I do not think the Braves are ready to compete. This is a team with deep, deep holes on it still, and you can only get so much value out of having one or two really, really great players. You know, the Braves have Ender Inciarte and Freddie Freeman, and those guys are awesome, and everybody else is bad. And somehow Julio Teheran is bad now. You know, they've got such big holes on their roster, and they're kind of in a position that some teams are in where they have good but not good enough players to fill in at other important positions. You know, when you're running Matt Kemp out there in left field, great, he is a good enough player. But where are they going to upgrade this team from the outside? Are they going to replace Kemp? Because that's going to be a very expensive proposition. They can improve a lot at third base. So go out there and get Manny Machado. Oh, wait, you're not going to, you know, that kind of thing. So I have some deep, deep reservations about this team until guys like Sims and Fried establish themselves as second or third starters in a rotation, because that's the place where they're really going to need to demonstrate some significant improvement in order to be a contender.
I agree with that. And we do have one more move to discuss here. It also involves a talented youngster getting a shot. And that's because Sean Brody has been promoted to a featured writer at Beyond the Box Score. So, Brian, in the vein of Adam Rosales, what is your favorite Brody moment?
Oh, geez, I have so many. But I would say that one of my favorite moments is every opportunity that we get to talk to you on the show. Your completely random stories about guys like Jared Hoying and Rosales are very enjoyable, but this is a great opportunity for you to write as a featured writer for baseball, for Beyond the Box Score. And we just wanted to say we're really excited for this next step for you. You did a great job at Sabre Seminar presenting. And so, you know, we're just really happy for you, man. This is well-deserved and best of luck.
Thank you. It means a lot.
I would say, though, my favorite moments tied between the random pluckers, I believe it was.
Yes, that was reference.
And also when he admitted that he once, while mowing the lawn, somehow ran over his debit card. So one of those two would be my favorite moments. I don't even understand the mechanics of the second one, but.
So the story behind that was that I have this thing where I lose my debit card or like my wallet or like my ID or any like essential things that I need to live daily lives. Like, I lose them. And so one time I was at my friend's house and apparently it fell out of my pocket, or I was doing something and it was out of my pocket and I couldn't find it for weeks, and I ordered a new one. And then like days before it came in, I got a call from my friend. He was like, "Hey, my roommate was mowing the lawn and he almost ran over your debit card. Do you need this?" And I was like, "Do I need this? Like, I have a new one coming in." So,
well, as long as you're able to keep your important personal documents in order, I'm really excited for your future at Beyond the Box Score and elsewhere. So best of luck to you in that new role. And please don't quit our podcast, because if I am stuck producing it, we are in big trouble.
I think we're in big trouble regardless. I mean, the man keeps Adam Rosales' facts closer to his heart than his debit card and his wallet.
So Adam Rosales actually also batted second against Jose Quintana. So apparently that's their tactic against the Cubs. They're going to bat Rosales second and third against lefties.
That's a good spot to end it, I think.
It's a great spot to end it. Like Adam Rosales, we are adequate. We are adequate and deserve to be seen frequently by Chicago Cubs left-handed starters. So thank you very much for listening. You can find out more about the DFA podcast at Baseball Prospectus, where all of our shows go up. You can also read RJ at CBSSports.com. You can read Sean, as we have stated, to much fanfare at Beyond the Box Score, where he is a featured writer, at BP Mets, where he reviews all of Rafael Montero's starts because he's a masochist. You can read me at Baseball Prospectus. If you could rate and review us on iTunes, it would be wonderful if you would do so, even if you need to rate and review us as your least favorite baseball podcast about transactions. I feel like it would just be very helpful to us to get our names out there and get those reviews in so that other people can find us. God forbid they want to hear more about Ryan Garten or Adam Rosales. But thank you very much for listening, and we'll catch you guys next time.